We are having our last huge public event to celebrate that fact from noon till 10 p.m. on Southeast 8th Avenue, one block south of the station. Station tours on an open house all day. Live music in the street. You want to be there. That is August 11th, noon to 10 p.m. on Southeast 8th, KBOO's big block party for our 50th anniversary. Take care. Stay tuned for more coming up at 9 Pacific Underground.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next on Pacific Underground, they get personal with T. New, owner of Project Object, about her family's hardships as refugees in America and her experience running a small business. At 10, Valley Views talks to the co-founder of the Corvallis chapter of SURJ, Showing Up for Racial Justice. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and 11, it's a Radio Geekly with a discussion of non-binary characters in geekdom. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by your support. If you'd like to become a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join me every first and third Friday from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. We will ease your troubled mind with licensed mental health counselor Cheryl Jefferson, political analysis provided by the Prophet of Rage, and calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues, musicologist Professor Soul. From the Grassroots, I'm your host, Lanita Duke, on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
It's just a great space that we like.
My favorite is you have these hoop earrings that on one earring it says F that, and then on the second earring it says hoop earrings.
Yes.
And it's so good.
Yeah, those earrings are one of our like best sellers. They are from a Seattle artist. She's a really great person, and she started making some jewelry, and that's one of her pieces, and it's pretty awesome.
Hey Portland, this is V on Pacific Underground. I'm one of your co-producers here, and you are listening to KBOO FM Portland. I'm sitting here today with T. She's the owner of Project Option. Project Option. and it's a retail space storefront in Northeast Portland. And yeah, would you like to tell us, I guess, introduce yourself and
sure.
then tell us a little bit about the space?
Sure. My name is T, and yeah, I own this space called Project Object, and we support artists and designers' works who are women, LGBTQ, and POC. And part of our proceeds goes to different nonprofits. And within the space, it also acts as like a rotating art gallery where we have rotating work from original works to illustration, prints, and we've also had murals and installation artwork that's switched out every month or so. And then we also hold events, fundraisers, workshops, just really fun and great things that kind of bring the community together, a place where you can feel safe and be able to share whatever you feel like sharing. Retail space, we try to carry items that empower and inspire people. It's just a great space that we like.
And you sell some of your own jewelry there as well.
I do, yeah. So I have a jewelry line also called Upper Middle Class. And I started that about 8 years ago. And I basically started that off of like, I was in between jobs and trying to figure out my life and just had really bad experiences in my life where I just wasn't respected. There was sexism, racism, lots of things that that I guess would make me go home crying, you know, mm-hmm. every night. Like, it was just such a bad environment. And eventually I left that industry and started trying to figure out like my life and what I wanted to do, and fell into making jewelry, just mm-hmm. taking some workshops and made a few things, and then it just kind of, friends and family and just random people started asking me like, oh, where'd you get that? And from there I figured like, oh, maybe I could start selling these, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, like 6 months later, it was just caught on. And at that time, minimalist small jewelry wasn't really prominent, and it just took off. And I went from like full time to part time, and that hobby turned into like a part time, then to a full time.
Uh-huh.
So that, you know, I started out in my bedroom and then worked my way to like bigger spaces,
mm-hmm.
into like a living room or mm-hmm. or an actual bedroom. And with my jewelry, I've always had the need to use it in a way of being able to help like organizations, you know, organizations that I believe in that are doing really great work that I may not necessarily have all the tools to do myself, but I can support these organizations that are doing amazing work for the community. And I think one of the reasons why I kind of am so, I just love being able to do that is because of my background. And with my background, it's, you know, I'm Chinese Vietnamese. My family were pretty much like in the middle of the Vietnam War, and
mm-hmm.
my mom had to go through a lot just to get us to America, you know, like a lot of Asian American stories, it comes with having to sacrifice and having to lose your home and, you know, whatever you had and your identity. And what you did or your job, everything, you know, to be able to get on a boat to safe ground and bring your family to a better opportunity, a better life, you know. So my mom, she struggled and made it happen, and she was in camps for a long time, and
refugee camps.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Eventually she was able to get on a boat with my family, and they sailed over to Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And they escaped by boat, pretty much. It's just packed like sardines. Mm-hmm. And there's hardly any food and hardly any water, but you know, they're sacrificing, like, it's so bad that they are willing to sacrifice their lives and try and just get to a place that's safer, you know. Mm-hmm. So they ended up in Hong Kong, and that's where I was conceived, and they were in there for some time, and an American family sponsored my family. Mm-hmm. And flew us over to Minnesota, and then shortly after I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of this when I was younger or anything, you know, you grow up and you're into the things that you're into, which is like, I don't know, TV and playing games, or, you know, worrying about a girl or a guy, you mm-hmm. know, in school and stuff. And, you know, you don't see all those things. But as I grew older, I started to realize, like, all the sacrifices my family had to go through, and all the people along the way that have helped us to get to where we are. And if it wasn't for those people who sponsored us and then and helped get my family to, I guess, learn to live in America, mm-hmm. then I guess we wouldn't have the opportunities that we have today, mm-hmm. you know. My brother also, when he was really young, my mom found out, you know, after a while, he just kept getting sick and wouldn't get better. And finally she took him to a doctor and realized, like, he had leukemia. So a type of cancer. And at that time, and it still is, it's hard to find, like, a bone marrow match. Mm-hmm. But at that time, the chances were way less, just right. because the amount of people trying to be donors was just, the awareness is a lot broader now than it was before. But luckily, they were able to find doctors at the children's hospital that were able to work with him and try to find him
a match
and just take care of him. And it was pro bono, it was all free. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about that. I think about how the doctors were just so kind, and all the people along the way that, like, helped us. And, you know, I just, you see all that and you think, like, you know, you can't, I mean, I can't go through life just taking and thinking completely about myself, mm-hmm. you know, 100% of the time, because there are, I don't know if anybody believes in karma or anything, but mm-hmm. I feel like if you're doing something good, then it puts out good in the world, and you get that back in some way too. So it's just like a cycle. And I believe that it's important to give back, whether it's a service through your own self or doing something that,
and that's what you're doing through Project Object. Project Object started as kind of a project to give back,
mm-hmm.
which I find really interesting, like, as you were talking about kind of your guess your family's migration history and like kind of how you got to survive and survive in America as immigrants, as refugees. I just thought about how, you know, there's this model minority myth that, you know, everyone thinks that Asians are just so hardworking and that's why they're like so successful. And I always think it's interesting because like when I think about my family, like we got a lot of help from, like we were sponsored as well.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of help from our Catholic community and just community in general. And so it's like these agencies, these nonprofits and these medical providers and like people helping each other out. It's never just like an individual like pulling up their bootstraps mm-hmm. and like doing everything on their own. It's like people coming together and helping each other survive.
Right.
So I think that's like a really beautiful thing that you're doing with your store. And it kind of debunks that myth that, you know, like it's about, you know, being resilient and then also finding and seeking out help when you need it, and putting your trust in others and just being kind to one another. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I love that. I'm curious, I mean, you've mentioned a little bit about your mom and, like, you know, I know just from speaking with you earlier that she's been a huge influence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what she's like. And
My mom, she's got like, I feel like she's a pretty amazing and strong-willed person. She's just gone through a lot through her whole life. She had a really tough childhood. When she was younger, she grew up with 16 brothers and sisters. She was one of the oldest, and she came from a very abusive family where her mom pretty much beat her all the time,
mm-hmm.
bloody, you know. And my mom had to quit school, I believe when like she was 12, because she was forced to take care of all the kids.
And you said that your mom traveled from refugee camp to refugee camp to the States.
Mm-hmm. So she was in the refugees camp in Vietnam. They made it over to Hong Kong. I believe there were some other family, you know, but everybody got separated, you know.
Right.
So she arrived with my brother, who was probably like two or three, maybe two. My cousin, who she adopted him. So my aunt, her sister, pretty much was like, you know, you have to take him. If you don't take him, he's going to die here, because mm-hmm. he was really sick at that time and there's no medicine or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was better to risk him being on this boat traveling than him staying. So she took him. And then my uncle, who was about, I think he was probably like 12 or 13. And then I was not yet born, not until I was in, they were in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And my father ended up, they somehow met up again there.
Oh, okay.
And so then I was conceived.
That's right. And so you moved, your family traveled from Hong Kong to Minnesota with your father.
No, he went somewhere else. I'm not quite sure where he went, but he has, he had like another family,
mm-hmm.
actually two other families. So everybody just got separated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
So how long were you in Minnesota?
It wasn't too long that we were there. I'm not quite sure, but I was born and it was probably like not even a year mm-hmm. to 2 years. It was, and my mom, she met somebody in her English class and she heard that she was going to California, so mm-hmm. she decided to go too. Also heard it was warmer coming from Vietnam. It's like hot and humid, and then going to Minnesota, which is cold and snowy.
For sure.
And so she's like,
"Get me out of here! I'll like, go anywhere else."
So she heard stories about California, and her friend knew somebody in California who could get them work.
Uh-huh.
And so this woman had like a small business doing sewing. So she learned how to do some like sample sewing or just like do piecework, where it's kind of like you're just doing spaghetti straps mm-hmm. like for days, mm-hmm. like just sewing them and then turning them inside out type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then she eventually started getting bigger work and other things. And that's kind of like mostly what she started doing when she actually had work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that, and we ended up living next to a Thai family, and that was kind of nice because they had some kids and we were all around the same age, and they took turns taking care of us and
child care. Yeah.
So it was a nice community.
Yeah.
And then eventually, we ended up moving, to a different part of the city. And we ended up moving to a small house, and my mom started bringing over, you know, doing paperwork and bringing over my aunts, my uncles, grandpa, grandma. My dad was always in and out. He was always like he would come and see us, and then mm-hmm. he'd go. And I didn't know at that time, but he was at, you know, checking up on the families, you know, mm-hmm. making sure, I guess, everybody was okay. I'm not exactly quite sure.
Yeah.
once all the family was there, it was, I want to say there was probably like at one time, like 15 people living in one house.
Wow.
Because
how many bedrooms were there?
From what I remember, there was probably like 3 or 4.
Wow.
So there was a lot of people in the house.
Yeah.
I remember that. And then eventually we moved out and moved to the projects. So it was my brother, my uncle, me, my brother, my mom adopted, mm-hmm. and her. Yeah. So we lived in the projects for a little while, and I think that was a really good experience because I, you know, it was dangerous living there because there was a lot of gang activity. It wasn't quite safe. But at the same time, there was also community there.
Mm-hmm.
Our neighbors were really awesome. It was just like, they were super nice. And we had a Vietnamese family that lived next to us, a Hispanic family.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived in the Harbor City projects for a while, and it's now turned into, they tore them all down. I don't know how many years ago, but they're now townhomes.
Mm-hmm.
And our car would get stolen, stripped, come home, there's shopping carts on fire, gunfire every night, like, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. It had those things about it, but it also had those really great things about our community, and mm-hmm. you know, so we did definitely struggled sometimes, and at the same time, worked pretty hard to get out of it, and you know, my dad eventually came back, and stayed with us for a little while. For a few years, and he started working for this Vietnamese family, and the Vietnamese family had a landscape, I would say more gardening, because they did more maintenance work, and so he would go with them and, you know, mow the lawns, trim the hedges and stuff. My mom, she realized, like, oh, there's some money there. Mm-hmm. And and she's also really interested in, like, plants, plant life. I would say she's, like, OG, like, plant lady, you know? Like, when you say, because she's, you know, we every flight that she takes, she takes plants with her, like, literal potted plants. Yeah, apparently, because I came with her one day, and she had them, like, go through the x-ray thing, uh-huh. whatever they're called.
That's amazing.
But she does that every single time.
She started the trend.
But, yeah, so she realized, like, oh, you know, we can make some money off of this. It could be a good business for us. So she kind of learned through this Vietnamese family, like, some of the ways to operate. Mm-hmm. And then she put herself through school. It's like a vocational school, and learned landscaping, horticulture, and even learned about hardscaping, putting in sprinkler systems. And so she started from nothing, and they, you know, her and my dad saved some money up, bought some equipment and mm-hmm. a van, and then started with little flyers. And I would go with her and go door to door and put flyers in the door to get customers. And, you know, slowly people started to call and ask for, like, oh, can you trim my hedges? Can you maintain this? And little did any of them know that she really had, like, skills, you know? Like, they just saw this Asian lady with a really bad accent. Her English is way better now, but
yeah,
you know, people have perceptions, and they just thought, you know, oh, you know, nice old lady, you know, nice young at that time, actually, nice Asian lady. Okay, yeah, we'll help me with my yard. And she's very, like, charismatic and personable. So, a lot of people, just from talking to her and meeting a lot of her customers, she's also weirdly kind of like a therapist in a way for them, therapy, yeah. Because she'll come and then they'll just want to talk to her and tell her everything about their lives. So I think that's what they also like about her.
She should have been charging extra.
I think so. But yeah, eventually, you know, some of her customers started to trust her and be like, hey, you know, and she would, like, kind of plant some seeds and be like, hey, you know, I can help you with this project. Mm-hmm. Let me do it. Mm-hmm. And slowly, like, they started to see what she could really do. She can just, like, completely transform, like, something that looks, like, really dead and, like, vacant to a really beautiful garden. Mm-hmm. It became, like, a really big business. She had it for almost 30 years, and she eventually, like, had to start turning down people.
Yeah.
Because she had enough work. And she got some really big jobs, like multi-million dollar, like, house jobs, where she would work with, like, architects sometimes, or look at blueprints and help them plan out, like, the landscaping. Mm-hmm. And then they'd hire her to do these big jobs, you mm-hmm. know? Even till this day, like, people, you know, she's at Home Depot. She used to, like, the Home Depot that she would go to for so many years, like, everybody knew her, every single person. And it's funny because, like, she'll go to Home Depot now and, like, she'll hear something and she'll just say under her breath, like, no, you should get this, you know.
That's not how you do it.
Yeah, that's not how you do it. Don't listen to that guy. And sometimes also, like, she'll give her advice to people.
Unsolicited. Like,
I think this will work better for you. She used to, and, you know, she used to take me with her, and I would do work with her.
Yeah.
So I would do a lot of, like, labor work, like digging ditches or carrying heavy, like heavy hardscaping stones or, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was learning from her, you know. My mom just like was, made it very clear, like it's important to take the opportunities that we have and make something out of it so that we don't, you know, fall behind, you know. And with her, I learned from her like perseverance and determination and getting what you imagine and dream.
If you're just tuning in now, we've been sitting here chatting and kicking it with T, owner of Project Object, and I'm V, your host today on Pacific Underground on KBOO FM Portland. I'm curious how you got into jewelry making.
Oh, jewelry. It was just something I wanted to do for fun. It wasn't like ever like, I'm gonna do this so I can make money off of it. It was never like that. Like, I was like in a place in my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. Like the career that I thought I wanted to do the rest of my life wasn't it anymore. Like I was so burnt out from that whole industry. I was working in the clothing fashion world, and I don't know what it is. It must be maybe just me choosing the wrong, I don't know, companies or whatever. I'm not sure, but I just,
It sounds like you had some awful experiences just mentioning like the sexism and racism that you encountered in that, in the agencies or companies you worked for.
No, it was bad. It was bad to the point where I was like, I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't like allow it to happen to me or to other people. And I had to speak up. I couldn't be quiet anymore. Like I'm the type of person who will definitely keep things in, and I have my breaking points. And when I do, it's like I have no filter. And so with, one of my jobs, it was just, the woman that I worked for was just so racist, would just say things about the sample sewers and the cutters and just be, talk about how they should be like cleaning the bathrooms and, you know, like it's, there's a lot more, but and it just got to the point where I was like, I can't sit here and be quiet anymore. That's like, so I had to say something and I had to leave. So, and that was the same with my other job where I was in footwear and I became someone's right hand, I guess, quotes, man, you know, like I could do anything in that company. And I kept getting promised like raises and, you know, a position, but they kept hiring a white man every single time who knew nothing about what the business was about. And I would always
have to like teach him how to do his job.
I had to always teach them how to do their job, and always had to be in meetings and sit on the side and just like just be embarrassed because of what this person would say. And eventually I was like, I can't do this. And my boss was also really racist too, and said some really, called some people some bad, like, that's not, shouldn't be in anybody's vocabulary. I was like, I blew up and I had to go.
So what happened after that? Where'd you go?
I ended up finding a job through my husband, actually. He was in the the film production industry and had some friends and got me a job at this really great production company called Imperial Woodpecker. And this is the first time I have ever worked for anybody who really appreciated me, mm-hmm. who cared about me, who were very kind, respectful. And you could see it in everybody's like demeanor and how, you know, like everybody worked well with each other and there was no, you know, nothing weird. Everybody was, if I wasn't doing what I'm doing now, I would still be there because they were like so great, like the people there. Mm-hmm. And my boss actually was the one who encouraged me to kind of go for, she didn't say anything, but she just kind of let me do my thing mm-hmm. when I kind of thought about pursuing jewelry a little bit more, because mm-hmm. that's when I took on the hobby, was during that job. And she was the first person who actually bought a pair of earrings from me because she saw that I made some mm-hmm. and she took me off to the side and I was like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. Cause she was like, T, can I talk to you? And I was like, oh my God, what did I do? and she's like, hey, so I really like your earrings. Can you make me a pair? I was like, oh yeah, I'll make you a pair.
Yeah. So you're your own boss.
Yes.
And you know, after hearing you tell stories about kind of just like, yeah, horror stories about the bosses that you've worked for in the past, and now you're your own boss mm-hmm. and you get to call the shots and, mm-hmm. You know, make your own schedule or whatever. And what is that like? I feel like a lot of people think it may be a glamorous life to like, you know, to do that, but it seems like it's hard work.
It's not as glamorous as anybody would think. Mm-hmm. It's very hard work. With me, when I first started, it was just having upper middle class, and that was a lot of work in itself. Because I still am doing wholesale, retail, online, and some shows that I travel to. Adding to that is now the brick and mortar, and that's adding on like event planning and coordinating and buying and maintaining the shop. And I have to say that it's not just all me. Mm-hmm. Like you can't, you know, it takes some help from other people, and I have some really great people that do help me. Mm-hmm. Margaret, for instance, is one of the people who works with me. Like she wears many hats, so I'm very grateful to her. And I think that's something that I've learned with working in my past jobs, is like, you know, you can't do things on your own, so you have to treat people really well. I wasn't treated really well, and so I feel like I need, it's just like in my nature to like to be that person for somebody else, to mm-hmm. make them feel comfortable in their work environments and feel safe and feel open enough to tell me like anything, mm-hmm. whether it's like, I don't think this is something I want to do, or whatever the case, like I've always wanted to be open in that way. Mm-hmm. And,
you're trying to be the boss that you have always wanted for yourself.
Yeah. And I think when you have people that work with you that are happy,
things just go better.
Yeah, that's like very logical, and it doesn't make, how does the other make sense?
Right.
It doesn't. So, and since I've been working with Margaret, for instance, like it's funny because things have shifted into more of like, we do this thing in the mornings where when we see each other, we do 30 minutes like checking in, like, hey, how's mm-hmm. your day, or like what happened, and we just go through like this this talk about. It gets a little like personal.
Yeah, it's but, like relationship building.
Yeah, it gets a little personal. And, at, you know, in the beginning, I was like, oh, I want to be professional, keep like work
boundaries.
And yeah, boundaries. And now it's just like, I don't care. Like,
yeah.
I like knowing about her life. And I am interested in it, and I want to know that she's doing well, mentally and physically, and you know,
her
well-being is good. Yeah, I do genuinely care about her.
Yeah,
and same with Alex. Alex is part-time, but she's moving on to a really another great position, I think, is better for her. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage that too, is like, I don't ever see people who are working with me staying with me the rest of their lives. That's like impossible. Like, especially young people, it's like, it's, I think it's just important to encourage them to do what they need to do and to grow mm-hmm. from that. And when you grow, you move on mm-hmm. and that's okay.
And explore different things.
Yeah. And I just want the best for whoever is with me. Mm-hmm. And I try to make that, keep the work environment just like open like that.
Yeah. Project Object, and it's, like, your vision for it is to create this, like, space, this community space for mm-hmm. women, POC, LGBTQ folks to come together and share community and share kind of what they're working on. And, yeah, how did that come to be about? And
yeah.
And I guess, what do you think is the impact of it being in a city like Portland?
Well, I guess because I wanted more spaces. I wanted to see more spaces myself. Mm-hmm. I just figured, why not just make one?
Yeah.
So
it's not that easy though.
No, it's not easy at all. It's tough trying to run like a brick and mortar and also do like event planning and working on my jewelry line and all that stuff. So, but yeah, I just wanted to see something, and something that was safe, a safe space that people mm-hmm. can come to, have events and workshops that I would want to go to,
mm-hmm.
And I know that other people would want to go to, and I think it's important to have those spaces for people like us.
Yeah. That aren't so white.
I love white people.
Yeah.
I love everybody, but it's definitely when you have diversity, you have other people's perspectives, their life, what they've gone through, mm-hmm. and you see like the culture,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's important to bring everybody together to experience that yeah. through other people, 'cause I think that makes you a better person if you're more open to yeah. to their lives and what they're going through.
Yeah, maybe I should have said like a more inclusive space, because when I think of safe, it doesn't necessarily have to mean like physical or like emotional or mental safety. Mm-hmm. It just means like when and you know, walking into a space where you don't see anyone else with melanin or like anyone else that, you know, isn't white, it just feels like you're not really welcome there, that mm-hmm. like it's not an inclusive space,
right.
that they're not welcoming mm-hmm. diversity. And
yeah.
so I guess that's what I meant by like not so white. Not that yeah. like, you know.
I think the main thing with the space is I want it to feel like it, so it's it's pretty much like my home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want anybody who comes in to feel welcome,
mm-hmm.
like whoever you are.
Right.
Like, that's the important thing. And I think that we've pretty much accomplished that. There's some people who are just like, make some comments about it being too, I don't know, too forward, I guess.
Mm.
Which I don't think
like
I
it's too out there or aggressive.
Maybe or? Like the F the patriarchy or girl power. Like people, like women, some like older women have mm-hmm. come and checked out the space and were like, "So what's this girl power thing about?" I'm like, mm-hmm. "What do you mean?" Like, she's like, "Oh, is this like a trend or something? What do you mean?
Yeah,
why is girl power a trend?
Yeah,
why is it?
Yeah." And that's like a great opportunity to have dialogue and conversation around mm-hmm. those things. And it's, and even if people are coming in with, you know, ideas that may be different from what you are going for, you're not challenging. Well, you are challenging them like mm-hmm. intellectually, but you're not being like, "Oh, you don't like my stuff? Get out of my store."
Yeah,
you know, like it's.
Yeah.
It's a safe space in that you're mm-hmm. welcoming these conversations,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is wonderful.
Yeah, we've had so many people who've come in and told their stories, and I love that it's that kind of a space where they feel comfortable telling us, even on the first meet, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, it's just those things like are. I feel like are some of the most rewarding things when people feel like they can come in and be able to feel comfortable to speak their mind, to talk about whatever they feel like, and be able to get that sense of empowerment through these works mm-hmm. of really great people mm-hmm. that are doing some inspiring work.
Yeah for sure. I you said something about like success, and mm-hmm. I'm curious what your perception, or like I guess what your perception of success is as a small business shop mm. owner, and how that may be different from like, you know, the public's perception of success.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I think how I've learned success was, growing up was money.
Mm.
And that was definitely like something I've learned, is not the thing, because when you think about it, yeah, it helps to sustain your life. Free to eat, free to do like fun things, but at the same time, money isn't the answer. You know, mm-hmm. you can have all the money in the world and be unhappy, depressed. Like, it would be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you are okay, like internally.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you like work with that inside of yourself, I think with success, I have equated that to money a lot. And even though I've loved doing what I've done, and it's still for some reason like it. Like in the back of my head has always been like, "Oh, I'm not making like enough money, so that means I'm not successful."
Yeah, like that's capitalism
not for yeah you. So it's so ingrained mm-hmm. in our society, and I think that's one of the roots of like being a depressed person is because mm-hmm. of this like mindset of like, you know, money equals success, but it's not, and trying to unlearn that. You know, I think being successful is mostly finding a balance between what you love doing and your well-being, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's
And I think that speaks to kind of just like, yeah, that delicate balance of finding, yeah, how do you take care of yourself and take care of the people around you,
mm-hmm.
And be present with your loved ones, and also tend to this business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting, not interesting, but that's a perspective that should be valued more and mm-hmm. should be held more by business owners, I think.
Yeah. Retail business is not easy. The especially the brick and mortar, like, I don't think a lot of people, owners of businesses who have brick and mortars, talk about it as much. Like, I think it's definitely harder because, you know, you can talk to somebody and be like, oh, how's your business doing? Oh, it's doing good.
Uh-huh.
I think in a lot of people's realities, it's like, I don't know how this month's gonna do.
It's like, hold on, let me check the books. I'll get back to you in a week.
I think we might break even, or we lost some money this mm-hmm. month. I don't know.
Yeah.
The question is always, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard. It's not like completely all fun and like, oh, I get to like put stuff in this beautiful shop. And
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of stress that comes with it, and trying to manage it all
mm-hmm.
and manage that stress and be okay with like, all right, this is happening.
Yeah.
And I can't do anything about it.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're balancing that stress and that like uncertainty with community and with family and with creating this beautiful space that is a safe space, mm-hmm. that's an inclusive space, and you're inviting people in and building these relationships and yeah, mm-hmm. that's just,
yeah, it's like, it's super rewarding. I love the shop. Mm-hmm. I love everything about it. It's just definitely hard to sustain it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm trying to work on with the shop. Because you know you need people to
come in
and buy things in order for me to pay the rent or the people who are helping to help me create the space and to hold these events. So just trying to figure that all out.
Yeah.
It's all a learning experience. This is my first like retail shop, and I'm super open about it, and it's not easy, and mm-hmm. I don't know how every month is just kind of like, I don't know how it's gonna do. You know,
well, let me tell all of our listeners that Project Object is a beautiful space. It's located on Sandy. What is the address?
It's 2502 Northeast Sandy Boulevard.
And it sells the coolest things, from jewelry to t-shirts to candles to fragrances and what are they called? Like cards, like
mm-hmm. We have zines.
Greeting cards and zines. I just bought this super cool Frida Kahlo pin, enamel pin, and this cactus pin for a friend, and she loved it for her birthday. And it's just a beautiful shop. And you're usually there. What are your hours?
Wednesday to Saturday, 12 to 6 p.m. And then Sunday, Monday, 12 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
Closed on Tuesdays.
Okay.
I mean, it might shift depending on, we're always like trying to gauge like, what are the best days to be open? When are the best days to close? Because we also do need like a real day off. So, even though those days are like running errands or something. But but yeah, those are our hours, and you can always check it out on our website or on Google. Just look us up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, projectobject.co.
And it's not only is it a cool space, but it's POC owned. And so I'm always looking for places that are POC owned to support with my money. I mean, I think that's like these days, that's kind of the best way you can support businesses and people of color and women. And even Project Object is doing that itself with like a portion of the proceeds going to agencies that are doing good for the community. So are there any events that are coming up at Project Object that we should know about?
Yeah, we have a couple really great ones. August 3rd, there's a group show called Focus Flow Ground, and that's a POC art show with performances and food. And we also have on August 26th, and it's a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood and Next Level.
Awesome.
To come to you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that information. If you had one piece of advice you could give to someone who is a maker or who would like to open up their own business, what would it be?
I would say that just make sure that you are doing it for the right reasons, and that it's coming from your heart, and knowing that there's also risks involved. And I think if you're willing to take that risk, then it really means you're serious about it.
The Pacific Underground Collective would like to continue to publicly show support for those in our KBOO community who are in want and in demand of needed systemic change here at our own community radio station. While there are individual volunteers and staff who have shown a support of addressing these issues, we feel that there is a pressing need for the KBOO community as a whole to express their views regarding the radical space we all call our radio home. In our July 6th episode, we had 1 minute of dead air, and in our July 27th episode, we had 1 minute of a monotone. And we will continue to have monotone minutes in future episodes of our show until effective and lasting systemic change becomes a reality here at KBOO. In solidarity, we will now have that 1 minute of monotone.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next at 10 o'clock at Mulberry Valley Views, talks to the co-founder of the Corvallis chapter of SURJ, showing up for racial justice. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, it's a Radio Geekly with a discussion of non-binary characters in geekdom. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.